Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm the executive director at American Compass. And this week we're bringing you a series of special episodes from our symposium on the new conservative story held in late February at the National Press Club in Washington. Rana Forahar of the Financial Times, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, and David Lenhart of the New York Times moderated discussions on the economic debate going on within conservatism, the political reality of realignment, and the challenges faced by media in covering these developments. Today, we have the third and final session from the conference, David Lenhart's conversation with Emily Yashinsky, director of the National Journalism Center, and Idrees Kaloun, Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Enjoy. Third and final panel is on the media itself and the question of how we cover all of this stuff and what needs to be better covered and differently covered, and what the challenges are in particularly tackling a set of issues where the way that the country seems to perceive the economic situation, the political priorities that are so often in focus, are so disconnected from what the coastal media bubble seems to concern itself with. And to that end, I am delighted to have moderating the conversation David Lenhart, senior writer at the New York Times, runs The Morning, which is the flagship newsletter, a must-read and a better way to know what is really going on than scrolling through the New York Times homepage, where the best stuff is like 9 screens down, but it's always at the top of the morning. I think David has done an extraordinary job really focusing attention on a lot of these issues and perspectives outside of what his own readers are likely focused on a lot of the time. I don't envy his inbox. I hope you have an intern that has to filter it for you, but I would be sending complimentary notes. And David is also the author of the recent Ours Was the Shining Future, The Story of the American Dream, which I think is a terrific look really over the last 50 years or so at what has changed and why and what's wrong with it. It's interesting to look at the three books from our moderators: Homecoming, The Path to Prosperity in a Post-Global World, We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution, and Ours Was the Shining Future, The Story of the American Dream, a fairly good trilogy if you're looking for an understanding of what on earth is going on. So definitely pick up all three. And David, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Oren. Thank you all for having me. My book also quotes Oren. So I'm just going to talk quite briefly, then the three of us are going to have a conversation, and we're going to make sure we leave a whole bunch of time, because I think this conversation would particularly benefit from exchanges with you all, both because I know lots of people have complaints about the media, and we're happy to hear those and debate those. And since it's the third of our three panels, we'll leave time to lots of time to engage you all. So I just want to start by trying to frame our discussion. Obviously, many people feel very cynically toward the news media in all kinds of different ways. Often that cynicism, depending on what political tribe people are coming from, takes different forms. But I think cynicism about the media is very widely held. And while I actually have quite a number of criticisms of the media myself, some of which you'll hear over this panel, I think the basic idea I think there's too much cynicism about the media. I think that actually the dominant profile of someone in the media is someone who really is trying to do her or his job well. It's not someone trying to put a thumb on the scale for partisan reasons. I think it's people who are inspired by All the President's Men, or if they're too young to know what that is or to have seen it, by the ideas in it, which is we're going to hold people to account. We're going to tell truths and hold people in power to account. And if you doubt this because you are conservative, I would just point out that the New York Times and other media have played a role in bringing down pretty much every New York Democratic governor in the last couple decades: Andrew Cuomo, David Paterson, Eliot Spitzer. If the media was partisan, that's not really how you would see it behaving. And maybe a more important example is the 2016 election, when the media focused enormous amounts of attention on Hillary Clinton's email, which I think was a legitimate story. But we focused so much attention on it that at the end, when Gallup surveyed people and said, "What do you know about each candidate?" email was the number one thing American voters said that they knew about Hillary Clinton's candidacy, which is really quite remarkable. But if the the consensus view of the media, including from the right, is too cynical. I also think we in the media often are too defensive, and we say that we're really doing our best and leave us alone. And in fact, I think media coverage tends to be flawed in ways that are not random. And again, we would have to separate different parts of the media. So I'm not here talking about Fox News, which I think has a whole lot of problems. And I think it's, if you're a fan of Fox News, it's worth engaging with the fact that polling suggests that people who watch Fox News are more likely to believe things that simply aren't true, like where President Obama was born. But I'm instead talking about what is often called the mainstream media, the elite media, publications like those that are represented here today. And I think those of us who work there do not look like the rest of the country in a bunch of notable ways. We are substantially more educated. We are more affluent. And yes, we are more liberal. An academic study recently, which tried to combine survey data with Twitter behavior, found that about 80% of national journalists lean to the left. 66% of them were to the left of where this study put Barack Obama. So you're not just talking about most journalists being on the left half. You're talking about a large portion of journalists being on the left half of the left half. And that does affect our coverage. We also happen to run counter in multiple ways to the new right. And so if you think about who is writing for the kind of publications and working for the major networks and working for NPR, many of the beliefs that we have run counter to the core of what the new right has become. So I'm old enough to have attended college in the 1990s. And in the 1990s, people loved to talk about how they were socially liberal and fiscally conservative. And I think a lot of journalists imagine that as the sort of center of American politics. If you then look at what the new right is, it is in fact the flip of that in so many ways, right? We see people in red states and purple states voting for voter initiatives that increase the minimum wage, voting for voter initiatives that expand Obamacare. We see them deeply skeptical of trade, as you heard from our earlier panels. They are skeptical of immigration. They want to defend Medicare and Social Security. They are also religious and they are patriotic and they didn't want schools to be closed for months and months and months and months on end. These are many of these views in both ways run counter to, I think, a lot of the background that our media comes from. And so that's what we're going to talk about and how we in the media might be able to do a better job. And I am going to be joined by two fantastic people to talk about this. Please come up now. Emily Jashinsky is the culture editor at The Federalist. I specifically recommend following her there, and a couple of her recent pieces on Ron DeSantis and on higher education really caused me to think. So thank you, Emily. And Idris Cahoon, who is the Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist, who's recently written a fascinating cover piece on national conservatism. He also, like me, is an applied math major. And while I will not speak for Idris, you can guess how well I did in applied math because I became a journalist. So let us start with a point, Emily, that you made when we were talking about this panel, which is you think a lot of these divides and a lot of the problems that I just highlighted sort more on class than on ideology. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank you to Compass for putting this on. I do think so many of these divides are now increasingly downstream of class. So the first book that we assign to our students at the National Journalism Center is Coming Apart, because specifically, it is true. Everything that David just said is true. When you look at affluence, when you look at education levels, when you look at people's backgrounds in the industry of journalism, they tend to, you know, fall sort along those lines. But the really key thing here that I think Murray captures very well in what I always say is the best book about journalism that has nothing to do with journalism, is that those class divides increasingly, in ways that they hadn't decades ago, now carry with them a suite of major cultural divides. So what you watch on television, if anyone has taken the bubble quiz, has anyone taken Murray's bubble quiz? It's on the PBS website, it's fantastic. It's outdated now, but where you go to dinner, what kind of movies you watch, what kind of television you watch, all of this is now, in ways that it wasn't decades before, salient, based on those class metrics, like your education level, your affluence, and where you live. And the vast majority of jobs that cover national politics at a high-profile level are outside Washington, D.C., New York City, Los Angeles, you could even extend that to Chicago. So that creates biases and blind spots that I think the real problem with journalism right now is that we're not aware of them. And if we could become aware of some of these things, you know, it's not just about the money you make or the education you have. It's about, you know, belief in God. I pulled some stats here. Belief in God is actually lowest among people whose household income is over $100,000. These fragile community residents nationwide, so this is from Gallup, they have their fragile community metrics, 74% say people like them are treated at least fairly by the local police. And then that actually goes up with the number of very fairly. It's really surprising stuff. So I say that to emphasize this is not just about the white working class. I think, you know, there's a reason you don't see perspectives like Jason Riley's represented in much of the corporate media when it comes to race. I think it also affects the way we talk about race. I think it also affects the way we talk about sex. Actually, it's something that's still like 60% of journalists are men. I think that affected the coverage of the Me Too movement. So a lot of these things, we just have blind spots that have crept up in the last couple of decades that make it very difficult for us to cover people fairly because we're not yet aware of them. We're aware that we make more money and we have a higher level of education and that most journalists detest Donald Trump. But to cover people in two ways, as both rational and decent, when they disagree on those points is really, really difficult. And the final thing that I'll say on that is I do agree, David, that most journalists are not putting their thumb on the scale for partisan causes. The problem is we now increasingly associate some of these cultural differences. You know, defund the police. Why was it so hard, even for the mayor of Minneapolis at the time, to speak out against defund the police? Because we've increasingly associated these differences on cultural issues with being indecent, with being perhaps bigoted. That has made it very, very difficult for people to even have these conversations, but also to see people on the other side of the divide of Donald Trump as both rational and decent. And those cultural barriers make that really hard.
I'm just going to jump in for one sec before. I think that's a really important point about the decency and the idea. And I do think that's something, as much as I think the media really doesn't put its thumb on the scale for partisan reasons, I think that is something that we should be more reflective about, which is there are a whole bunch of debates, COVID being one of them, immigration being another of them, in which we either usually implicitly suggest that one set of views is hateful or ignorant, and that is deeply disrespectful of people. You've just written this cover story on national conservatism around the world, or at least in much of the world. Could you talk about what you think journalists of the kind of publications we're talking about, like yours, like mine, are missing around the world? And to me, to build off Emily's point, it really is not just ideology, it's also class. I mean, I reflect on the fact that neither, Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong, the Wall Street Journal nor the Washington Post had an opinion columnist who was favorable to Bernie Sanders in 2016. Now, maybe that's expected from the Wall Street Journal, but it's pretty striking that the New York Times did not have a single opinion columnist who was favorably disposed to Bernie Sanders, who got 45% of the vote in the Democratic primary. And so it seems to me there are parts of this debate also on the left that we are missing. And I'm interested how you see that beyond the United States, yeah, given this global news organization you work for.
And thank you for this, and Oren for inviting me. You know, I looked at national conservatism, of which, Oren, I think you're kind of affiliated, at least on the economic front, and I looked at how it was kind of taking off, not just in America. You know, Viktor Orban sort of sees himself as, and he's devoted a lot of state resources to kind of propelling this idea forward. And earlier we were talking about how the right used to be the party of freedom, the left used to be the party of equality, and I thought that there was a sort of shared base of like classical liberal values, the kinds that the Economist kind of valued. And what is so interesting about the national conservative movement is that it rejects that framework, or at least a lot of its intellectuals see themselves as not liberal. They see the foundation of conservatism as national sovereignty, and that is the base out of which they build everything out. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of interesting tangents we can go on with that piece, but one thing that emerged, and that's relevant to this discussion, is that this is not just an American phenomenon. This turn inwards, this feeling that, you know, the hegemonic left is coming, has taken over the cultural institutions, and is coming for a certain way of life that ought to be protected. That's common across a lot of countries in Europe and America. And so I think that should help us try to understand what the causes are. Because I think if we're looking for only American causes for a phenomenon that is clearly kind of global, we won't really be able to find them. You know, Thomas Piketty has done a really good study where he shows, he divides kind of parties of the left, he calls the Brahmin left and the merchant right, right? And he points out that educational polarization, which we've seen in this country, has gone on not just in this country, it's gone on in I think, 40 or so, right? So in Brexit, you see a very similar kind of educational divide, people who are in the managerial class, people who are in London, people who benefit from free capital flows, voted overwhelmingly to remain. And those who were kind of more left behind voted to leave the EU. You see kind of similar patterns in France around deindustrialized areas north of Paris, and they're voting for Marine Le Pen. So that suggests to me that, you know, something else is, something bigger is happening, something more kind of overwhelming than maybe just an America-specific phenomenon. That's why I also think, as important as the American media is to try to understand this issue, it doesn't seem to me that we can find the solution only here. And on the point, as I agree with everything you said about class and all of that, I think there's also been a structure to the way that elite journalism is kind of done. And I've talked to my colleague in the pipeline of getting into it. I've talked to my colleague, James Bennett, who you used to work with at the New York Times, who's now at The Economist and is a fantastic, fantastic person. But we've talked kind of what's kind of changed about journalism for obvious reasons. He thinks a lot about this question. And he said, you know, he has a more kind of almost simple explanation for what might have gone wrong in elite institutions, which is that, you know, when he started, you know, 20 or so years ago, the first beat you did was crimes and it was court. And it was not ideologically kind of valent. You went, you didn't know anything, you learned the mechanics of actually doing journalism. And then later on, you kind of moved into these more kind of ideologically salient kind of coverage issues. And there, we kind of skip over that. I mean, there are people who kind of jump straight in to kind of writing opinion pieces about things, and they don't actually know the mechanics of picking up the phone and talking to people who you disagree with, coming up with and being able to really understand alternative ideas, and then we get into trouble. And I think particularly when, you know, I think the COVID reporting, where you were kind of the kind of contrarian almost, right, by correctly pointing out that, hey, maybe learning loss is something we should think about. That is, you know, somehow we get into that position. I think part of it is this kind of mechanistic function as well.
Let's talk for a second about bubbles, media bubbles, because there's a real debate about whether they actually are a problem. And I think our instinct is, with social media and the fact that now liberals can subscribe to one publication and conservatives can subscribe to another, this is a real problem. And it was better back when we were all listening to Walter Cronkite. But actually, if you look at the empirical research, it's pretty mixed. And, you know, Brendan Nyhan at Dartmouth and others have done work that suggests this isn't a huge problem, that on social media, actually, people do have relatives or friends, enough of them of the other view, that they see stuff. And they've done experiments where they expose people to more views that they disagree with. And it doesn't actually seem to change their views at all. And so I guess I just want to maybe provocatively suggest that for all of our problems in the media, this notion of bubbles may have been a little bit exaggerated, and invite each of you to agree or disagree with me.
So I agree that it's the potential downsides of it have been exaggerated. I agree that that bubbles exist. What's interesting is, you know, the history of media in the United States. We just talk about the United States. We talk about sort of the partisan pamphlets that were prolific at the time of the founding, and how new technologies, you know, radio, television, created basically a licensing structure. And, you know, you had just a few things, and everyone was chasing. The example I always use is, you know, why is Stephen Colbert so different than Johnny Carson? So Stephen Colbert was the number one rated late night news host during the Trump administration. He was the most polarizing and arguably like the least comedic on a nightly basis. You know, he was like not always chasing laughs, but Johnny Carson was also very political. He just wasn't partisan, right? And Johnny Carson was getting huge numbers. We're talking north of 10 million every single night. Stephen Colbert was the number one late night host with maybe 2.5-ish million viewers a night. And so the difference is, Stephen Colbert, when you sort of have this new ad structure, you're not like Johnny Carson trying to get everyone to tune into you every single night. Stephen Colbert was basically trying to get a slice of the kind of resistance to be a loyal viewership, tunes in every single night. We see these similar patterns, financially, the sort of ad structure patterns in media. But institutions in media have not yet sort of reckoned with the reality that they're now just towards niches, that they are not, you know, covering the whole country for the whole country. They're covering the whole country for, you know, the slice of the public that is subscribing to their elite outlet or to their conservative outlet. I mean, conservative outlets have generally been aware of that just because they're sort of always, they've been born in that sort of world of niches, although they have the same problem. I mean, there weren't a lot of people in conservative media that were supporting Donald Trump when he was romping through the primaries, just like the Bernie problem. It was all Ted Cruz in 2015, 2016. It was almost all DeSantis recently. So I think that problem exists in conservative media too, to a different extent. But I think the big thing that has to happen is people who purport to cover the whole country, but who are responsive to a slice of the country, who are responsive to an ad base that is pushing them in one direction, and that direction in a lot of ways is an echo of their own experiences, have to reckon with that and be honest and say, you know, this is a left of center paper. This is a you know, progressive paper. Just come out and understand what you're doing and sort of give up with the pretense that was so popular in the era of mass media.
If you had to predict 20 or 30 years from now, we are going to look more like Europe in terms of there's Le Monde on the left and Figaro on the right, more like
The Guardian.
And honestly, as you pointed out, more like the United States for much of our history.
Yeah.
Right? We still have papers named Democrat or Republican. So you think that's probably where we're going?
I hope that's where we're going, because I think the most damaging thing, again, from the perspective of people, I hear all the time people just absolutely detest the media from the right or even from the center. The big thing is they feel like they're being lied to. So I hope that's where we're going, towards that direction of transparency, at least with the slant. I think that's much healthier.
Do you worry more about bubbles, information bubbles, than my question suggested?
I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said. I think that, you know, we're sort of like post like Tower of Babel, right? You know, like God has kind of, you know, compelled us all to speak in our little languages. And so I wonder whether media, like you said, is becoming kind of fractious and more kind of, you know, you capture like niches. And I think part of that is again due to structural change. It's technological disruption. It's the fact that, you know, the outlay you need to actually start up a media outlet is very low now compared to what it was historically. So you can do that with Substack. You can do that with YouTube channels. You know, Steve Bannon has set up, you know, War Room, and he gets quite a lot of people who come in and you see it, and they get exactly kind of what they want to hear. And I think with kind of more, you know, established mainstream outlets, these similar dynamics of audience capture have come into play. I think that, you know, Fox certainly had to row it back after 2020 when they initially said that, you know, they called Arizona probably incorrectly too quickly for Joe Biden. But, you know, the outcry after that meant that they really changed their coverage. And, you know, I think you see it with the left of center outlets as well. What I worry about, and I agree that kind of the European model of having left and right papers might be better, but what worries me is that there doesn't seem to be kind of a common standard yet across these different ideological niches, that there isn't, you know, the Telegraph in the UK is conservative, but it does really high quality work, mm-hmm. and it's kind of trustworthy in a way that I just don't really see at the moment here. So I worry a bit about that. But on the whole, I do think that we are. I do worry about these bubbles. And going back to the kind of original point about how journalists are kind of formed and how they think about things, I think that it's hard to, you know, I think you can have an opinion, but I also think that you can objectively cover the facts, and you can objectively kind of assess what the alternative view is and present that. And I think that, you know, I just don't see that in a lot of kind of American media. There's this kind of almost sneering attitude towards anyone who would be stupid enough to disagree with the position that I've laid out, and that's something that I dislike, and that I hope that, you know, we can do better on. Maybe I should be more hesitant about that since I work for a publication that speaks with the British voice of God, but you know, I do think it's important.
Can I make a super quick point on that, which is, and David, you've written about this, let's just take school choice, for example. One of the real barriers, I think, to growth in, you know, coming up with an American telegraph is that, for example, the left standard line, you know, from nonprofits, the right does the same thing, but on school choice, for example, it was that this was a racist conspiracy theory. You know, that's what partisan sort of people were saying in their partisan warfare. Totally normal stuff. Again, the right does the same thing with its partisan causes. That became mainstreamed in the media. And the media started treating school choice like some of these partisan nonprofits, or these, I shouldn't say partisan nonprofits, but these sort of ideologically committed nonprofits were doing. It sort of adopted the propaganda line. And instead of treating those comments skeptically, like the media would do, you know, if you see your job as Johnny Carson, not Stephen Colbert, from the media perspective, you would treat that fairly. But now, if you're a conservative outlet and you're talking about school choice, you are treated as though you are propagating a racist conspiracy theory. And that's just one issue. And so it's very, very hard for conservative media to grow and to create an American telegraph in an environment where, you know, you're constantly, even for something as simple as school choice, you're treated as someone propagating a racist conspiracy theory. And that is a huge obstacle that scares me towards, could we get to, you know, a more European model? I don't know. It's very hard to grow in that environment, especially in this tech atmosphere.
I think one thing, and then please get your questions ready because we're just about to open up. I think one thing that is a little bit helpful and maybe a small cause for optimism is over the last, the way politics have shifted a little bit over the last 5, 6, 8 years, it is harder now to make the case that this is simply about race in the United States, because we have seen a meaningful shift of Latino and Asian Americans to the right, and we've seen a small but statistically significant shift of Black Americans to the right. And so this idea of the kind of Brahmin left, I don't love the phrase merchant right, although I love that Piketty paper, because they're actually more working class right, yeah. but whatever, the Brahmin left, which is a great phrase, and the kind of working class right, we see that with every group, every major racial group in the United States. And so I think one of the things that I'm now spending a lot of time on college campuses talking about my book, which is quite a delightful experience, actually. And I think one of the things I often challenge progressives to do is look at actual public opinion, including public opinion among Americans of color, on a whole bunch of these issues. And it isn't what you necessarily think it is. Right? Clear majorities of Black Americans, of Latino Americans, and of Asian Americans, as well as white Americans, believe standardized tests should be used in college admissions. Mm. Right? A really good review of why Latinos in Texas moved to the right in 2020 by a progressive group cited two factors: COVID closures and lack of border security. Mm. Right? That's not what the Brahmin left would suggest is the case. And so I completely agree with you. There's a chilling effect on some of these conversations involving race. But I also think there are ways in which public opinion should help open up some of that that conversation. Mm. Okay. Were you going
to
add something?
No. I think you're completely right. I mean, also a majority of Black Democrats and Hispanic Democrats support charter schools, for example.
Right.
I mean, you know, I mean, it's just, and so that is the slight kind of, where do I worry about bubbles in media? I worry about bubbles in the kind of white progressive kind of core, and these sort of weird ideas that bubble, like standardized tests are inaccurate and shouldn't be used because they're inequitable. Like these are that affirmative action. I mean, affirmative action nationwide couldn't even pass a referendum in California.
Right.
Right. I mean, so the way that these issues are talked about, I think, particularly in mainstream media, is very out of touch with how even Democrats, even non-white Democrats, on whom, you know, on whose behalf a lot of these issues are sort of named, you know, if you actually talk to them, they would say something very different. But
it is the case. I do wonder why we don't have, and maybe it's simply the fact that the audience for these things are elites, and that's the answer. The market isn't there. But if you think about
we don't have publications that are both skeptical of affirmative action and skeptical of trade.
We have your publication.
Yeah, which is skeptical of affirmative action.
Yes, which is skeptical of affirmative action, yeah. But not of trade, right? Yeah. We have the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, but it's interesting. We don't really, I mean, I guess Fox News is the closest thing, but we don't really have a mainstream publication that reflects the social moderation or conservatism along with the economic moderation or progressivism that I think it describes much of the country.
Mm. That was definitely a problem with the DeSantis campaign. Sorry.
Yes. And I meant it when I said, feel free to raise criticisms of the media, ask us to reply.
Oh, no, nothing like that. I'm Evan Myers. I'm with the Heritage Foundation. I wanted to ask about how the realignment on the right, sort of what you were just referring to in terms of popular opinion and whatnot, is affecting the media landscape. You know, National Review is sort of the publication of whatever you could consider the conservative movement in the mid to late 20th century in many ways. That's, you know, obviously changing. I used to work at National Review. Just the movement has changed and the media landscape has changed. So, and it's not clear to me that another publication has like really emerged as sort of the flagship publication of a movement or of some kind of realignment movement. I'd be sort of curious as to your thoughts on, you know, why that is and what might become of that situation. Is a publication like National Review possible in the new kind of technological and media landscape? Do publications still exist in relation to political movements the way they did at a certain time? All sorts of questions like that would be interesting to me for you guys to discuss some of those things.
I'm going to give a very brief answer that's more about the business of media, and then I'll defer to you all. We have had this funny situation in which it's not just National Review has faded, but if you think about some of the journals on the left or in the center, mm-hmm. they've also faded, right? And I think part of the diagnosis here is that all of sort of political journalism, which can be very influential but tends not to have a massive audience, basically made a bet on traffic a decade or so ago. And it was a reasonable bet, and it also was a failed bet because Google and Facebook get the revenue from ads. So if you're making a bet on traffic, you're saying we're going to monetize this through ads. But actually, the ad revenue doesn't go to you. It goes to Google and Facebook. And so I think the emergence of Substack, as well as the success of, again, the publication, the larger publications you see here reflected today, the FT, The Economist, The Journal, The Times, The Post, shows that the subscription model for like high-quality journalism is the way to go. And I think what we're going to probably start to see is more publications that look like The Free Press or Liberal Patriot, which are basically, they take the Substack model, but then they tried to kind of build you're not just subscribing to one person, you're actually getting a worldview which will replicate the old political magazines. And so I would hope we're kind of at a dawn of an era where some of those will emerge. But I'd be interested about what you each think about what publications are the closest to that now.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think a lot of it does just simply have to do with the business model. I think that's the vast majority of the answer to the question, that there's just... there are already too many conservative publications, honestly. Like, there's a million of them. And conservative publications are generally pretty good about having, like, bringing in a bunch of different voices. And I mean, like, new media conservative publications. Like, people always will associate the Federalist with one thing or the other, but I guarantee you, if you're associating us with one thing, we have David Harsanyi writing the sort of libertarian perspective on something, on antitrust or whatever it is. And so conservative publications, I think, are in that kind of routine. So they're, rather than sort of becoming, you know, a hallmark of one slice of the movement, I think they're constantly like trying to publish different voices. The other thing I'll say to that is, that said, one of the biggest biases in media, if not the biggest bias in media, is working in media. And conservative media, you know, people who consume news and live on Twitter are biased. And that's something I think, you know, they're biased in their perspective towards the news, simply. The news cycles. They consume things very differently than the average American. And in the same way that I think a lot of mainstream journalists have not yet recognized their blind spots, it's a huge blind spot of the conservative movement. And I think it seeped into the DeSantis campaign pretty obviously. And in ways that are class-based. Because again, if you're working in media, you're more likely to be educated, you're more likely to make a decent amount of money, and you're more likely to live in certain areas of the country. And that, you know, I think blinded even conservative media to what was still driving people towards Trump in a primary setting. Tim Carney did great work on how social capital, you know, in the 2015-2016 cycle, you know, who was voting for Ted Cruz? People that had, in red states, high social capital. Utah. Why was Utah totally for Ted Cruz? But then if you go to where I'm from and you look at rural Wisconsin, where offshoring has ravaged certain communities, they were for Trump from the beginning. That affects even conservative media, and I think that's a real obstacle towards having a strong, robust publication in that vein.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think DeSantis was the candidate for the conservatives who care about the composition of Harvard's Board of Overseers. Right? It's a niche. They're all, you know, several of them are probably in this room. But, you know, that's that. I mean, I'm curious why Breitbart and Daily Caller didn't sort of assume this mantle, because I think they kind of prefigured this in a way. And there have been new conservative publications like The Bulwark and The Dispatch, but they're you know, emphasizing the Never Trump aspect of the movement. So they kind of succeeded in that way. I don't know. I mean, there are certainly intellectual journals like Julius's and the Claremont Review of Books that try to kind of elaborate this, but I don't know why there hasn't been a kind of... It's an interesting question. I talked to a producer for Tucker Carlson who used to work back when he was on air, who used to work in publishing, and I asked him why he moved from publishing to Tucker, and he said that he thought that Tucker Carlson was actually the center of the intellectual kind of movement on the right, which, you know, I hadn't thought of, but actually I think, you know, you could say that he was actually articulating a lot of these views and probably doing a lot more than any journal itself could have. So
he didn't mention the relative pay difference between publishing and TV.
Well, he's back now.
Yes. We'll try to go quickly. I appreciate all the hands.
Hi, I'm Bradley Devlin. I'm with the American Conservative. My question for the panel is, we live in a media environment that presents as very decentralized. You guys mentioned Substack, people with Twitter accounts or YouTube channels can have a large effect. And yet, when you look at the legacy or the elite media institutions, there's a high level of concentration, whether we're talking about News Corp or Time Warner, CBS, Disney. First, you mentioned previously about the citizen free press model. I thought that was a really interesting look forward into what could happen to the media landscape. But if you guys could talk about this concentration that has happened, particularly over the last 20 years in elite media, and what kind of structural impediments or incentives that creates or disincentive that creates to do good work, and what kind of challenges that a concentrated media environment creates. Thank you.
Who wants to take it?
I think there are like three sets of biases you can worry about. You have audience bias, you have journalist bias, and then you have ownership bias. And in my mind, the journalist bias and the audience bias and the feedback loop between them is a lot more powerful than the corporate bias. And I'm sure it exists, but by and large, you know, journalists, when they do the business of journalism, they kind of pursue their stories and their interests. There isn't like unless you're at a very kind of high level doing something huge, a lot of kind of communication with the bosses about what exactly the story should be, what it should include. But I think there is this implicit understanding of what audiences want, and there's the kind of bias that journalists have in the milieus that they live in and the kind of people that they interact with that seeps into their kind of stories. And so maybe you guys disagree, but to me, I feel like that set is kind of more informative than the corporate kind of top-down imposition, because I think that's hard to do to journalists, but maybe...
No, I agree with that, but I do still think concentration can matter. You're not saying otherwise. And mm-hmm. I mean, just to take a specific example, at very high levels, which can matter because it can affect publication. I mean, I think I'm sure it has occurred to people at the Washington Post that Jeff Bezos owns them, right? And if you want to have a long-run future of helping to run the place, how could it not occur to you that one of the richest people in the country owns it and he has certain interests? So I think it matters. I think the good news is the barriers to entry are sufficiently low that I would hope for the whole ecosystem it's not a huge problem, but yeah. Oren, did you have your hand up? No. Okay. Let's keep on going.
I'm Micah Meadowcroft with the Center for Renewing America. So if the new right is correct that we have entered a post-hegemony, post-globalization era, and American politics has to respond to that. I would say that that's kind of what the new right is actually about, is responding to something they see as basically inevitable. It's not casting a vision. The pessimism is the reality that they think they're addressing.
Not standing athwart history.
Yeah. Stop. Then how do institutionalist publications, like in that scenario, so if this is true, then how would institutionalist publications like the New York Times, like The Economist, that have been champions of the liberal international order, respond to a world in which multipolarity is a given now, in which illiberal regimes are just a matter of, you know, whether it be China, Russia, India, what have you, you have to live with that. So how does it change those publications, how they do journalism?
I mean, do you mean more in our coverage or in the reality that some of these regimes try to put those kinds of businesses out of business?
More in your coverage, thinking about how the world especially with The Economist, probably more so than The New York Times. But,
well.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, we have, you know, we have two functions. We have a bit of a normative function, which is, you know, espousing our classical liberal values. Like our first issue had a series of corn prices, and we were for free trade from the start. So, you know, we always will champion that, and that's more at our leader pages. But descriptively, like, our job is to say how the world works, and the world works, you know, in ways that sometimes we don't like, but our job is still to describe it. And so I think that the actual kind of business and the actual kind of, you know, how do you go about reporting in these places is something we spend a lot of time thinking about. We have a lot of really good China coverage, for example. I think it actually tries to understand mm-hmm. the country in its own terms. Sometimes, and we emphasize having a lot of kind of foreign correspondents at a time when a lot of even kind of very successful American, you know, newspapers don't have that. So I think that part is kind of unchanged. You know, in our leader pages, like the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the New York Times editorial board, we'll continue to say what we think, you know, the world should look like. You know, I don't know if that makes any difference, but we'll continue to say that. So,
I mean, at our best, journalists are fascinated by new developments, right? And so what I would encourage other journalists to realize is this is a really important development, and we should see it as an opportunity to go learn about the world. As your question suggests, it's not quite that simple, right? But it can cut both ways. The surprising aspect of it should be something that appeals to some journalists.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by the support for the idea that the best way to resolve the discrepancy between the stated ambitions of news organizations and the reality of the biases of the people who work for them is to ditch the stated ambitions and just own up to the biases. Because I don't, in this whole conversation, I think it's revealing that the only way we know to criticize the performance of media organizations is to avail to the values that we're saying should be kind of discarded as old-fashioned. So we're saying news organizations are out of touch. And, like, you know, no one's saying, you know, the problem with media is that they're not effective enough at advancing their partisan objectives. We all, I think, implicitly, or I think this conversation reveals that we don't even have a vocabulary for evaluating the media that doesn't depend on the obvious correctness of striving for objectivity, you know, and trying to overcome the biases. So it seems like the better solution would be to try to do a better job of embodying the traditional stated objectives rather than give, you know, it's rather than giving up on the project entirely.
I understand.
Why not both?
Yeah. I mean, just to say one thing about the New York Times. Look, that is what we aspire to do with the New York Times. And I know many people here have criticism of the New York Times. And so I'm not saying we always, I'm sure I wouldn't agree with some of those criticisms and might agree with others, but we don't always meet what we're trying to aspire to. But read, A.G. Sulzberger is the publisher of the New York Times. Read his piece on independence. He makes that argument very forcefully. Oren was nice to note that I write the flagship newsletter of the New York Times, and you noted that it was sometimes contrarian on COVID. I couldn't do that if the bosses didn't want that, right? And so we really do aspire to those standards, and that is what we're going to be trying to do for as long as I can foresee. I also see Emily's point about where much of media may be moving.
I think there's a really big problem, which is if the biggest problem is the kind of the cultural things. If that's kind of baked into the worldview that, you know, conservative positions on, and this isn't even on economics, but if we're talking about cultural stuff on race, sex, gender, at least at the moment, the polarization is so intense there that if that's kind of baked into the worldview, I think the neutrality on, you know, and the New York Times has had some excellent coverage of hormones and all of that stuff. So this isn't specifically about the Times, but if that's going to be a barrier, if those various cultural issues are going to be impossible to overcome, then I don't think neutrality is going to be possible. But I do think that there are still some people that absolutely can and should strive towards it. I think those who cannot should reckon with whether or not that's true and recognize that they probably cannot and then be more honest. But there are ways, absolutely. I do think there should still be people striving for it.
Okay, we're going to end with lightning round because I just got the 5-minute thing. So if you have your hand up, please make the point quite quickly and then we'll respond to the points, each of us, briefly at the end.
I want to respond to your offer to hold your feet to the fire.
Good.
If the New York Times wasn't a cesspool of leftist mentality, then why doesn't Barry Weiss still work there?
Okay. We're going to keep going.
Or James Bennett.
You resisted, and you got a lot of audience pushback
for your work on COVID and school closure from the left in particular, which I think you resisted very well.
Thank you.
But there was a lot of the pushback from inside the House, and all the most interesting controversies the New York Times have been about internal pushback over the Tom Cotton essay or what have you. Isn't that more of a long-term threat to good news coverage than the audience doesn't like what I say this week?
Yes? Was there? I saw a hand here. No. Okay.
So, I mean, a lot of the conversation today is about political tribalism and reporting through the prism from the Republican tribe versus Democratic tribe and other subsets of those. I represent the Times of Central Asia. We cover the former Soviet republics, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and I observe that the Western media, as almost an entire ideological block, sees the region very much through their own ideologies. I think the gentleman over here spoke to this issue, but what can be done to understand more of the context and the culture of this region? It's also the whole emerging world. Some of them have democracies that are only 30 years old, and a lot of the concepts that are pushed and reported on completely, they don't resonate at all with the local population.
Okay.
So just a Thank general you. Observation.
Couple more. Oh, a panelist strikes back.
I'm a little bit of a media optimist. Just wondering if anyone could comment. I used to work at a paper that was the oldest paper in New York State, and when I looked back in the archives, it was just like ripping tales from the Mexican War and like a lot of like sensationalist racism around the time of Reconstruction. But anyway, the new business models seem to empower some really good work. The Economist last year put out a podcast series on Xi Jinping, mm-hmm. that was unbelievable. So what are the opportunities for matching the business model to work you're actually just proud of? Oh.
See, last two, and then we'll respond.
So the number one obstacle right now to the future you outlined, where we have a left-wing media and a right-wing media in America like they have in Europe, is that our right-wing media doesn't actually represent the right that we have. Everybody at National Review hates Donald Trump. The Wall Street Journal is hostile to the Trump realignment on trade, immigration, foreign policy. So, you know, right-wing media is the only place where you can find real-life human beings who voted for Evan McMullen. So if we're worried about having a media that actually represents Americans out there, we've talked a lot about the left-wing bubble. What do we need to do about the right-wing bubble?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Last one in the front row here.
If I'm reading an ideologically diverse set of publications, Jacobin, Dissent, American Affairs, Claremont Review of Books, Economist, but I'm not reading outside of my class, do I need to change that?
Okay, so we have Barry Weiss, we have COVID and internal pushback, we have young democracies, we have media optimism, we have the right-wing bubble, and we have reading outside of your class. I do not expect each of you to respond to each of those, but pick a couple you want to respond.
Do you think Fox News is kind of closer to the mark than certainly the Wall Street Journal editorial board, or do you think that they're also bubbly?
Not since Tucker.
Okay.
No. Well, so I'll just say one thing that we try to do at Federalist in the vein of federalism is we try to publish non-professional writers who do not live in Washington, D.C. or New York. And that was always our model, is that most of our stuff, I don't know if this is still true, but at least for a while, it was most of our stuff was published by people who are not professional journalists, who are just moms on the school board. Like, this is how we were ahead of the curve on the Loudoun County stuff. And I would actually encourage other outlets to do a similar model. So it's not just, you know, taking op-eds from, you know, a Koch network group, but taking op-eds from real people outside of the bubble and actually having that be a part of your news gathering operation. I think one big answer to all of these questions is, you know, local, the death of local news is something we haven't talked about, that actually on a class basis, it really did, as you were mentioning, David, it was that pipeline to professional or to national coverage. You went through crime and courts to the point that James Bennett made, and that really changed the way that you saw the world. It was your training ground, and that has dried up. That pipeline is basically non-existent anymore, and that's a real problem. I don't think it's coming back. So there are all kinds of real problems there, but one way is just, and this will be my final point, one of the things that in a weird way made me want to work at The Federalist. Everyone remembers Roy Moore. Everyone in the media was asking for weeks, who are these 50% of Alabama voters that with all of these sexual assault allegations are still going to vote for Roy Moore? Who are these 50% of people? The Federalist published an op-ed from a regular guy who said, I'm voting for Roy Moore and I'm in Alabama, and people tried to cancel us over it. Amplifying the voices of people that we see as not decent and not rational because they disagree with us on some of these really big issues, his response was literally just Doug Jones supports abortion. And I do not want to send a senator from Alabama who supports abortion. That was it. It was a simple answer. Maybe you disagree with it, but if we elevate those voices in the death of local news where they don't have a lot of elevation, that's, I think, a very healthy thing to do.
Okay, I'll do the lightning round answers. So Barry Weiss, whose work I really admire, left the Times at a really miserable moment for us and for America, right? It's the 2020, people were so angry at each other. I think she was very clear about why she left. It is important to mention, she left, it was her choice to leave, not the Times'. And I think whatever you think about those months, I think it's important to say that I think the Times has tried to signal, you know, since then, Bret Stephens has criticized the 1619 Project in the New York Times, right? Ross Douthat continues to write what he writes. So we're not perfect, but we are trying. I am incredibly grateful to my colleagues who had a somewhat different reading of certain parts of the COVID evidence than I did. They were entirely respectful and professional and collegial to me throughout. And I don't think I am not aware of a single quote of me criticizing them or them criticizing me. And I have to say, I think that's how journalism should work. We talked about it. They did a lot of great journalism. I learned a ton from them. And I think you want these big publications basically to be orchestras rather than, you know, everyone doing the exact same thing at the same time. I completely agree about right-wing media not being representative. And it's not just about Trump, right? Trump's such a singular figure, right? I mean, he lies constantly. And I think it's important to say that. But let's just think about the politics, right? Just the policies, the kind of things. We also don't have the Wall Street Journal or The Economist or these right-of-center publications, or at least editorial pages, even agreeing with much of the new right on policy. And I think in some ways, even if you control for Trump, even if you're more favorable to Trump than I am or less favorable to Trump than I am, I think to me you're hitting on something really important that's even beyond Donald Trump. I absolutely agree with you. We should read outside of our class. And then just to end on a note of optimism, there have been a couple references to my own experience in the last few years as someone who's asked readers who may not necessarily agree with a set of instincts to grapple with that. I will tell you that, yes, sometimes people say nasty things about you on Twitter. It is mostly an incredibly positive experience. It's not that different from what you talked about, the good side of when you elevate certain voices. In this polarized society we have, there is no faster route to having no influence whatsoever in the media than telling your readers what they already believe, right? It just doesn't matter. I think the most read piece I've ever written is a complete list of the racist things Donald Trump has said over his career. I have no regrets about that piece. I'm glad I wrote it. I think it had zero influence. The things I've written where I actually ask people to grapple with their own priors, I think has probably had more influence, and it's actually extremely rewarding once you get past the insults, which you should just get past, right? Because people are mean and it's going to happen. And so I guess what the thing I would leave people with is, if you're a conservative who's frustrated that you don't see these things in conservative media, go out and change that. It's actually incredibly exciting and rewarding, and it's reminded me of why I got into journalism in the first place. So, Oren, thank you again for having us, and I think it's time to eat.
All right, well, I guess we'll make you guys sit here for the little wrap-up. I actually have something relevant to you, so that works well. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for this discussion, which was fantastic and connects precisely to the two points I wanted to wrap up with. But first, also wanted to thank the American Compass team People are often surprised to learn American Compass is a total staff of 6 people, not the event staff, the entire organization. So that was our communications director planning the entire event, our chief of staff doing every piece of the logistics, and our coalitions director and policy director checking you in, running the mic, and making sure everything went smoothly. So thank you guys. You are the best team in Washington, and I am incredibly fortunate to get to work with you every day. Two points I want to wrap up with. One is I was pleased. I don't think the word populism was said today, unless I missed it. But I'll go at the premise that it didn't. And I think that's actually really important. I think at this point, populism as a theme has outlived its usefulness and become just a derogatory term for things I don't like and don't agree with, especially if said by people I don't respect. And a central premise of what we're doing in American Compass, and I think what is happening on the new right, is a recognition that actually in a democracy in particular, people's views are inherently deserving of respect. And that if you think you're absolutely right about something and nobody disagrees with you, that's sort of your problem, not theirs. And so I was struck in particular, something we do a lot of at American Compass is surveying of very different types of questions than most public opinion surveys ask. And it was just interesting to hear the number of times today I wanted to jump up and say, like, oh, we did a poll on that. Like on the question of, you know, would you rather pay more for reshoring manufacturing versus for fighting climate change? We've actually asked Americans that. Would you rather move to opportunity rather or, you know, see efforts made to rescue the places where you already live, that theme. Would you rather have a free ticket to college or an apprenticeship that leads to a good job? How do you even define the American dream in the first place? You know, what is it that Republican voters actually do think about these economic issues? Because they clearly are very unified on a lot of the cultural points and have a tremendous amount of disagreement still on the economic ones. I think it's only through actually understanding where people are on those issues that we're going to build any sort of coherent politics on the right. And I think one of the most valuable things for me from these conversations was hearing how often that really is the crux of the matter, and that what's going on even in media on the right at this point is still a failure or a resistance to engage with that. And that leads me to the final point, which is I will take this opportunity, seeing as it came up so much just now, to announce, as we will publicly this afternoon, that American Compass will be launching a publication in a few months. Its mission will be to address the economic and cultural concerns of ordinary Americans, and it will attempt to, as American Compass has been a flagship for the policy work on some of these subjects, try to play the role in the media ecosystem of bringing some coherence and ultimately consensus to the political side of the equation. Because I think, as was addressed well by you guys, one clear lesson from the DeSantis campaign is that even among the right of center and the media ecosystem that is very focused on learning lessons from Trump and moving beyond Trump, it's not clear that actually the correct lessons have yet been learned. So we hope you'll all tune into that. We hope you'll continue to follow us. We hope you'll follow all of these panelists and the work that they're doing, and we hope you will join us for lunch to insult them, which it sounds like they are perfectly comfortable with. Thank you so much for coming, and enjoy the rest of the day.